Okay. Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Have a listen, whether you're recovering from the Sweet Pea Weekend or your recent getaway into the beloved wild places well outside of human events. I've continued to have lots of little excursions this summer, and it's always good coming home. Well, Ken Lane didn't create a lot of episodes in late summer months. I imagine he was traveling. So I have exhausted his archived material for August in any year. Till he releases a new one, and that might be soon, I'll dig deep into the library for other months. Thinking you might be up for something of the unknown, I found this one for you. I hope you'll like it. It's from January 13th, 2023. Here is Space Monsters and Other Earthly Demons.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. The year is still so fresh and new. We don't have to talk about stoves all of a sudden. We can do better. Let's do better. Let's talk about monsters. While podcast hosts and basic cable crews put on camouflage hoodies and aim to trap the Sasquatch by earthly means, I will attempt to remain honest on this radio show. Not gonna gin up a public fight with Jordan Peterson over the reality of his possession by an ancient clown demon, the immortal trickster. Nor shall I challenge Joe Rogan to a wrestling match just because he won't tell the truth about paranormal entities. We are out here on our own in the Mojave Desert. We keep our own counsel. Last week, we were talking about the bizarre highway roadblock in New Hampshire that changed the lives, ended the lives, you could say, of Betty and Barney Hill in September of 1961. It's the story that provided us all with the parameters of the flying saucer landing. A lonesome road in nocturnal wilderness. A mesmerizing light that transforms into a seemingly solid shape that we recognize. A glass house lit up on an Irish country road, or a spaceship in the 1960s, sure. And a voice that speaks to us telepathically from within. A lot was going on in the world 62 years ago. Things moved fast in those days of marvels. Of satellites thrown into weightless orbit by the force of our rockets. Of dogs and monkeys sacrificed to Apollo by the scientists of American and Russian space programs. Humans were next, but they, for the most part, returned to Earth. 1961 was when CIA headquarters first opened in Langley, Virginia. The Hills experience occurred on the very same day that a 1,000-acre property donated by Rice University in Houston officially became NASA's Manned Space Center, today's Johnson Space Center. That's just historical context. Many of us are still fascinated by the story of Betty and Barney Hill. Some people dismiss their experience with the excuse that the stress of being an interracial couple in that time made them hallucinate a dramatic encounter on a highway in good weather, or that it was all a misidentification of Jupiter or an optical illusion caused by a temperature inversion or whatever. People always want to tell you what it was, especially when they did not see it. When they were not anywhere around at all. So that upcoming movie about the Hills' alleged abduction won't be the first film about Barney and Betty Hill's long strange night. The first was called The UFO Incident, a 1975 made-for-TV movie starring James Earl Jones as Barney Hill and Estelle Parsons as Betty Hill. I can't remember if I saw the movie on TV in that time when America endured a number of intense regional UFO flaps. But I heard about it, at least, because everybody was talking about the highway abductions in those days. It was a strange time when the adults would often whisper about their own experiences. The car goes dead on a backcountry road, a brilliantly lit something silently hovering overhead. And then it's 2 hours later when you wake up with weird marks on your belly, etc. And that time there was real fear wrapped up in the flying saucer hysteria. People were still waking up with strange memories of humanoid monsters leading them into an examination room where the cold eyes of the alien doctor stared down at you and Star Trek control panels flickered all around you. And from inside your bones, you felt that terrible, maddening hum, the buzzing, as so often reported across place and time, the buzzing and the thumping that the Hills heard, coming from within their own car as they hoped to escape from whatever phantoms had chosen the couple for the ancient game. The buzzing, Al Azif, according to Lovecraft's fake grimoire that was, like so many literary and artistic hoaxes, more true than false. Variously described within and translated from the ancient writings of the Arab world and the older realms it colonized some 1,300 years ago as bugs by night, those nocturnal insects of evil, the howling of demons, weird whistling of the wind, and the eerie sound of the djinn in the wilderness. The sound that announces the arrival of them. As a man from County Sligo in Ireland told Wince a century ago, when I was a young man, I often used to go out in the mountains over there to fish for trout or to hunt. I was alone trout fishing when there came a whistle, like music. Heard a noise like the beating of a drum, and soon one of the gentry came and talked with me for half an hour. He said, Your mother will die in 11 months. Do not let her die unanointed. And she did die within 11 months. Like with those couple of old boys in Pascagoula, Mississippi, October 11, 1973, Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker were also outside fishing. Within shouting distance of the shipyard gates, the shipyard where they both worked. When they heard a whirring and a whizzing sound, and then a large hazy blue light caught their attention, the whirring and the glow hypnotized the both of them. Large, wrinkly skin creatures with slots for eyes and mechanical lobster claws for hands. This would appear in front of the odd structure now hovering just 2 feet over the muddy bank. But there were other entities too, and apparently not so frightening to gaze upon. She was normal, Calvin Parker said of this exam room nurse. He was talking to a writer from Louisiana's Country Roads magazine a half century after the night that mostly wrecked his life, his future. Matter of fact, Parker said, if I'd been in a bar room drinking or something and was single, you know, at this time, I'd have probably asked her out on a date. She was human. Apparently attractive to this 19-year-old shipyard worker. Only her long fingers seemed alien. Maybe she was a piano player. Who knows? The famous UFO scientist J. Allen Hynek was there a day later to interview the two men who never had any intention of going public with their story. It was the sheriff's department that alerted the local media, and then it became a dumb zoo like always happens when TV and newspaper reporters swarm some victims of circumstance. There were polygraphs, sessions with hypnotists, and especially the tape recording that the sheriff's deputies secretly made of Parker and Hickson talking privately after the cops questioned them. These men were terrified, and Parker is heard praying aloud. Both of them are shaken, confused, wanting answers, but getting nothing but the ugly fame provided by American media swarms. As with the approximate location of the Hill's otherworldly roadblock, the site of the Pascagoula incident now has its own historical marker. In recent years, another dozen witnesses have come forward, describing the strange blue lights below and above the water, and the vision of a gray creature walking on the surface of the Pascagoula River, a demonic vision of Christ in deeply religious Mississippi of 1973. I don't know that anybody's really scared of alien abduction anymore. Ever since the ray beam from the cartoon UFO struggled to take away Homer Simpson, it has been a sort of a joke. A cultural reference we all get regardless of our culture. Beam me up, Scotty, there's no intelligent life, etc. It's easier to explain away within the context of our own clumsy attempts to escape the bounds of Earth. Must be the space people doing the same thing. Taking samples, holding clipboards. Oh yes, many of our 20th century entities have been seen holding clipboards. Mid-century engineer style, taking notes. Sometimes they need water for their alleged spaceship, leaving a bowl of fresh water out for the fairies at night has long been custom in Ireland and Wales and on the Isle of Man. An exchange of food is often part of the ritual meeting too, between us and them, the other crowd. As in this tale, heard in several versions in Brittany of a century ago. Like the larger fae, the Fionns kept cattle. And one day, a black cow belonging to the Fionns ate the buckwheat in the field of a woman of the neighborhood. The woman went to the Fionns to complain, and in reply to her, a voice said, "Hold your tongue. You will be paid for your buckwheat." Thereupon, the Fionns gave the woman a cupful of buckwheat and promised her that it would never diminish so long as none should be given away. That year, buckwheat was very scarce. But no matter how many buckwheat cakes the woman and her family ate, there was never diminution in the amount of the fairy buckwheat. At last, however, the unfortunate hour came. A rag gatherer arrived and asked for food. The woman gave him one of her buckwheat cakes, and suddenly all the rest of the buckwheat disappeared forever. On April 18, 1961, 5 months before Betty and Barney Hill's terrifying night, a plumber and poultry farmer in Eagle River, Wisconsin, had a more pleasant encounter with the unknown. The matter-of-fact experience of Joe Simonton on a bright spring day outside his farmhouse has more in common with the Breton fairy lore of old than with the Hills' uptight freak-out and rapid breakdown of their lives. And this Wisconsin farmer's encounter also involves that magical foodstuff. Buckwheat.
Where do you meet someone from outer space? Perhaps in the North Woods. Joe Simonton of Eagle River, Wisconsin, spins a yarn about an April morning in 1961. A morning when he says he came face to face with another world.
Right here is where this flying saucer, this UFO, landed. Right here about where I'm standing. And it was a big, huge thing, and I wondered what the heck it was. I was in my kitchen having a bite of lunch, and I turned around, put the dishes in the sink, and I looked out the window, and that's when I first saw this thing coming straight down, just like an elevator. And first I thought the roof went off of my house, and I thought, no, the roof is green, and this is bright. What the heck is it? So I rushed out to see what it was, and by that time, there was a hatchway opening up in the top of it, just like the trunk of your car. And then there stood a little man, I say a little man, about 5 foot tall, holding up a jug or a container, and he motioned, he wanted to drink. He motioned for water. So I walked up to him to get this jug, and I looked at his eyes, and they were so penetrating that I had to look away. So I went to the basement to get this water, and I thought, well, they want water, so I'll take it up to them and see what happens. And with that, I brought the water up, and he was looking at me when I first came out of the basement. But I didn't look at his face until I got right up to him. Then I looked up, and I handed the jug up with both hands, and I had that same look in his eyes, a sort of a penetrating look. And when he took the water, I balanced myself with this hand against the machine, and I stepped back a few steps. And then With that, he set the jug down, and he gave me a salute with the back of his hand, a gesture of thanks, I presume. And then, I gave him my salute. What am I going to do? So I noticed this little man, the same size of a man, right to the right side of the hatchway, cooking these pancakes, which I have one here yet. He was frying these pancakes, and I pointed to him and made a gesture like eating. I thought maybe I'd get a conversation out of him. Nobody was saying anything. But he didn't say a word. He just reached over and he got a handful of them, four of them, and he handed them down to me. And they were hot and greasy. And this man cooking these pancakes, it was on a square grill-like concern. I couldn't see any flame, but it seemed to be very hot. There was smoke coming from it. And if that was their food, God help them, because I took a bite of one of them and it tasted like a piece of cardboard. And if that's what they lived on, no wonder they're small. And with that, he reached up and he closed his hatch with a heavy thud click-like on it latched. And you couldn't a bit more see where that hatch was than you could see a hole in my hand. And with that, the thing started to raise, just like it came down. Everything was timed perfect. It went up about 20 feet. It tilted a 45 degree straight south and shot off. And within 2 or 3 seconds, it was out of sight. Well, there I stood in the driveway with a handful of greasy pancakes, my mouth open, wondering what the heck I'd saw, what had happened.
It is outside the realm of the Air Force to pass judgment on Mr. Simon's case. However, the pancakes that he turned over to the Air Force were turned over to the Food and Drug people, and they were analyzed as pure buckwheat pancakes.
Well, I don't really know what to say, especially since I began tonight's broadcast vowing to avoid the topic of cook stoves and cooktops, gas ranges, etc. But the visitors to Joe Simonton's farm 62 years ago this April can play their pranks with no regard for time. This is from the transcript of Wisconsin County Judge Franklin Carter's interview with Joe Simonton on the Friday following the incident on the chicken farm. Judge Carter asks what the other men inside the craft were doing, and Joe answers, "One was busily engaged at the panel or control boards, and the other seemed to be cooking food on a heating unit of some kind." Judge Carter, "Was it an electric stove or a gas stove of some kind?" Joe Simonton, "I could not see any heated grill nor flame, yet he seemed to be cooking or frying cakes. The man in the hatchway noticed my interest and walked over and scooped up some of them and gave them to me. They look like pancakes." Well, it appears that the gas grill versus electric cooktop discourse was begun by the good people, the fair folk, in Eagle River, Wisconsin, a very long time ago. As for those pancakes, the photos in the Project Blue Book lab analysis make it very clear. They are buckwheat crepes. The beloved buckwheat crepe of Lower Brittany and Northwest France. The Breton galette, savory and delicious, with a big bowl of strong cider served alongside it, hopefully. The national dish of Brittany, home of the Corrigans, the Fionns, and the immortal Morgan Le Fay. Because wherever you find the name Le Fay or Lafayette or Fayetteville or any of the variations, you know where you are in the realm of Le Fay. or nothing is ever quite as it seems. For instance, you could take a road trip out to the Fay Cemetery on the eastern end of Lincoln County, Nevada, close to the Utah state line, just up the dirt road from Fay Canyon, not far from Area 51 either. And you've probably heard of Santa Fe, New Mexico, home of an ancient pueblo filled with shamans and wizards long before the cross-bearing mystics of the Spanish arrived. In the case of Santa Fe, Fe means faith. There's a very small town in Utah in the center of the state called Fayette. It's named after Fayette, New York, which is where Joseph Smith began the Church of the Latter-day Saints. Amboy to Zizek's and across the Great Mojave Wilderness and beyond, you have been listening to Desert Oracle Radio with soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Our closing theme music is by Pierre Langer, and I am your host, Ken Lane. Keep an eye out for the new Deserts issue of Alta Journal. It's a large print magazine you can find in independent bookstores in California, especially. Because if you love the desert, you will find much to love within this winter 2023 issue. There's even a piece by me, copiously illustrated, that tells the tale of trying to keep a little desert magazine afloat in this world of flat digital displays. Speaking of, I am again taking subscriptions for Desert Oracle, the pocket-sized periodical about the mysterious American deserts. Go to DesertOracle.com to subscribe and burn some sage or something to help me get this thing to you while it's still winter, at least according to the calendar. 4 issues for $50, that's about the price of a drive-thru dinner these days, but it does go far at a very small publication. Small in size, too. You really can fit it in your pocket if you have a regular back pocket, like on a pair of blue jeans or something. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our home station, Z107.7 FM in Joshua Tree, for keeping us here 10 to 11 p.m. every Friday night. Watch out for the next round of wild winter storms on the way. And good night from the Voice of the Desert.
The birds are a little upset because my cat just walked by. It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, at 95.9 FM, and streaming at kgvm.org. let's bring things back to the known and have some readings about our critters and season. From Nature, One Day at a Time by Kathy Katz. On August 3rd, she opens with a quote from Isabel Allende in Aphrodite. And Isabel wrote, "Appetite and sex are the great motivators of history." And Kathy continues with this entry. She writes, "Generally, spiders eat anything smaller than themselves, which creates a problem for males, who are almost always smaller than females. How then does a male approach a female? Well, in some species, males present a gift of a silk-wrapped insect. He carries the gift, holding it in front of his body as he tentatively moves closer until she takes it from him with her fangs. This way, her defense system is occupied long enough for him to climb on her to mate. This doesn't always work, as is nature's way, and a male with an empty package or too small of a gift will be eaten on the spot with no chance to escape." And then she closes with a quote from Diane Ackerman in A Natural History of Love. "Animals have much to teach us about our own romantic habits. There are many parallels. Male animals often give the equivalent of engagement rings. Females often check a male's bank balance. And modesty, or playing coy, is as much a trump card for female birds or insects or reptiles as for humans." Those little angry wrens, they're just doing their job. And the cats are up here. They are really not bothering them. But, you know, they're just doing their job, those daddy and mommy wrens. They kind of sound to me like cicadas a little bit, and that's going to be our next reading. On August 4th, the reading begins. "Big and beautiful with clear wings and red eyes, cicadas, or magicicada, are sometimes confused with locusts, but cicadas are non-jumping insects and make a loud whining noise unlike any other wildlife. Their high-pitched sounds come only from the males and only during their summer courtship. Vibrations created from an elaborate and powerful muscle on the male's abdomen are carried over long distances through the summer air to females, who receive the signals with sensitive ears on their bellies. The females can identify the species by the frequency of the signals. When males and females congregate for mating, it's usually by the thousands simultaneously. Their numbers alone ward off predators, and they reproduce abundantly for several weeks during late summer." And then she closes with a quote from Castle Freeman Jr. in Spring Snow. And Castle writes, "Its noise is hard to describe. There is nothing like it in nature that I have heard. Imagine a whine, the sound of a power saw going on at high speed into a cracked board. You can't tell when you hear the cicada just where its whine comes from, for it seems to be everywhere, like air turned to sound." And from Daily Observations, Thoreau on the Days of the Year, edited by Steve Grant, August 3rd, 1857, Thoreau wrote, "It is so much the more desirable at this season to breathe the raspberry air of Maine." And August 4th, 1838, he wrote, "Whatever of past or present wisdom has published itself to the world is palpable falsehood till it come and utter itself by my side." Okay, he had his opinions, didn't he? Our full moon is coming up for this month on August 9th. And some names for August's full moon include the corn moon, rising moon, black cherries moon, and mountain shadows moon. Some people even call it the harvest moon, kind of splitting the name with September's full moon. But let's get back to that name, sturgeon moon. The sturgeon moon is named after the humble sturgeon fish. According to the Old Farmer's Almanac, sturgeon were a staple food for Native Americans in the Great Lakes region, and the fish used to be a lot more abundant during mid to late summer. Of all the bony fish, the sturgeon is the most primitive, dating back to the Cretaceous period over 120 million years ago. Thus, scholars often refer to the fish as a living fossil. Back in September of 2024, I interviewed Zach Shattuck of FWP, and about 2.5 minutes into the interview, Zach begins talking about sturgeon. I loved his enthusiasm so much, and I'm including it today in honor of the sturgeon moon. Can you give me your name and your job title?
You bet. So my name is Zach Shattuck. I'm a native species coordinator for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and I work out of the headquarters office here in Helena, Montana.
Cool beans. Thank you. And last April, I got to talk with the Death Valley National Park fish biologist at Devil's Hole, and we talked about the pupfish. And I wondered, is there any species, whether they're fish or some other aquatic species, since you cover that too, native to the Montana region that are rare or endangered? Can you tell me, do you have a list of them?
Yeah, you bet. So, and that's something that people sometimes forget about, that aquatic species doesn't necessarily mean just fish. I am a big fish nerd, so I'll probably focus on fish species, but I will tell you about some of the, at least kind of federally listed species that we have here in Montana in the aquatic world. And I'll kind of start with the two insects. These are the newest, species to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. These are two species of stonefly that are found in really specific habitats up in like the Bob Marshall Wilderness and Glacier National Park, and then down in the Absorkey Beartooth Wilderness area. So those are meltwater Lednian and then Western Glacier Stonefly, and both those are threatened species. And unfortunately, we don't do much with them. Where they're found is very, very specific and is kind of out of the jurisdiction of Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And those are two species kind of listed in a kind of a monumental way, in that they are sort of climate change refugees, that they are really being listed under kind of threats of climate change and receding glaciers in Glacier National Park, and are found really only in, you know, kind of the meltwater areas of these receding glaciers. Moving on to fish, though, we've got three species that are listed under the Endangered Species Act, and that's bull trout, which are threatened. Those are a type of salmonid, a trout or a char, on the kind of western side of the divide in Montana. And then we've got Kootenai River white sturgeon, which is a sort of a disjunct population of white sturgeon only found, kind of in this most upper reach of the Columbia there in the Kootenai River. And then finally, we have pallid sturgeon, which is a fish species that I work quite a bit on with our biologists out in eastern Montana. Both these sturgeon species are listed as endangered. And they are incredibly interesting critters and pretty rare.
Could you say more about one of those species?
You bet.
It could be your favorite or one that you identify as of particular importance right now.
So I, if you ask anybody that knows me, I have a hard time nailing down a favorite fish species. It changes day to day. It's hard to play favorites. I will say, I got one that we can talk about and kind of one that we listed above, but I did want to give kind of a shout out to a few fish that really love. And that would be, blue sucker, which I feel like is the fish biologist fish. And then sturgeon chub and sicklefin chub, which happen to be, two of my favorites. They're just little minnows that are found in these really big rivers of like the Missouri and the Yellowstone. And they just happen to be sort of favorite food items for pallid sturgeon, which is the species we'll kind of focus on. And I think, and I will say, just being in Montana, there is a lot to be I think, thankful for, in that we've got some incredible freshwater fish diversity. And that kind of lends just to being at the crown of the continent. And so we've got fish species that, have evolved in like the Saskatchewan River drainage. And we've got some unique fish that we find up there kind of at the very top of the state. And then we've got fish species that, derive from the Columbia River Basin. And then we've got all these really cool critters that have come up from Missouri and the Mississippi River Basin. And yeah, that brings us to pallid sturgeon.
Okay, and how would you identify that? To people like me that I'm not a fish biologist, but what would I look for if I'm trying to identify that, or just wondering, is this what I'm looking at?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple species that maybe you could kind of lump as being somewhat similar looking. But outside of these three species, really, there's just nothing else in the river that looks like them. So, we can kind of grossly lump paddlefish, shovelnose sturgeon, and pallid sturgeon. And between the two sturgeon species and paddlefish, there's quite a few differences, but really, what kind of makes these three, group and look similar is just they are super ancestral. These are some of the kind of oldest forms of fish that we have in Montana. And these are fish species that have, kind of evolved to their current form, somewhere late in the Cretaceous period. And the two sturgeon species that we have look very different from a paddlefish, though. A paddlefish has this big, long, people call them spoonbills. And that is the rostrum that people are kind of referring to. This is a big structure kind of in on their snout that helps them to forage for zooplankton. Similarly, with pallid sturgeon and shovelnose sturgeon, they've got this kind of shovel spade-like nose, which again, this is their rostrum, full of a little electrosensory organs and these guys are kind of like a metal detector on the bottom of the river. They're benthically oriented. They live on the bottom. And so they've got this little metal detector and it's helping them to find, things like little sand-dwelling mayflies, little mussels and crayfish, and things like sturgeon chub and sicklefin chub for pallid sturgeon. So their mouth is on the bottom. They've got these really cool barbels. And that's another thing that kind of helps them sense around their environment. That's really more a chemoreception. They're sort of tasting around them. And
Are barbels, I'm going to interrupt you a minute. Are barbels like they look kind of like whiskers on a
that's right.
catfish? Okay.
Yeah. And yeah, you will have to interrupt me because once you just, it's like a top, once you set me off, it's just going to go.
It's
And
quite all right.
it'll be like, trying to drink from a fire hose. There's a lot of information to pick out in a short amount of time.
Okay.
But yes, they look like little whiskers. That's right. And they are full of just little nerve endings that help them, sense their environment. And with a shovel nose and a pallid sturgeon, really, those are two species that look very, very similar. They're both in the genus Scaphorhynchus. There are a total of three members in the world in that genus. It's
Wow.
Alabama sturgeon, which is incredibly endangered down in kind of the very specific drainages in Alabama, and I think maybe even in Mississippi or Florida. Don't quote me on that one. But with shovelnose and pallid sturgeon, shovelnose is certainly the most common of those three species, and then pallid sturgeon is another really rare fish. Between those two, you flip them over, you look at their rostrum. Pallid sturgeon have barbels, positioned in a way that their most outside barbels are a little bit posterior, so closer towards the tail. The inside barbels are a little bit more anterior, so closer towards the kind of tip of the snout. And a shovelnose sturgeon is going to have, kind of the insertion point for all those barbels sort of straight across, and those barbels will be all four kind of the same length, whereas a pallid, a little bit longer on the outside, shorter on the inside. Yeah, they've got, they're just very bizarre looking. If you ever catch a sturgeon, they're just striking because they don't look like anything else. They've, got this big rostrum. They got these tiny little beady eyes. They've got little sensory, pores all around their rostrum, and then they're covered with really sharp scutes. So they don't have scales per se, but they've got these armor-like scutes that will, go down the sides of their body, down the top of their body, and then on kind of the edges of their belly there. But otherwise, they've got, two pectoral fins, two pelvic fins, an anal fin, a dorsal fin, and a caudal fin. So they're a basic fish.
And we're talking about the pallid sturgeon and the paddle nose or paddle sturgeon?
So there's pallid sturgeon and then
Pallid.
shovelnose sturgeon. Those are
And
two really closely related
okay.
ones.
And do both of those, is there something unique about those species, or their place in the ecological environment?
Yeah, they are built for a big, turbid, sandy bottom, muddy river. The Missouri River, the Big Muddy, used to look, a little bit different than maybe it does today. We've done a lot to that river to make it, function for humans, and have changed it, in ways that might not be compatible with some of these fish species. But historically, it was a very muddy, lot of sediment, shifting sand bottoms, turbid river. And turbidity is just kind of, how much light can get through that water. So the more mud, sediment, silt that's in the water column, the more turbid it is. And sometimes, that river used to look very, very muddy. And that's just how pallid sturgeon like it. So if you can kind of, envision what a fish like that is seeing underwater, it's not, like a trout species that's really using their eyes to forage. Really, it's lights out. They're not probably seeing too much. So they don't have a whole lot of investment in their eyes. They've got really small eyes. But what they do have is, a large set of nares, which is essentially another way for them to taste the water. They've got this really big rostrum, and that helps them to kind of, pick up on some of those minute electro impulses from, other fishes. And then they've got those barbels to help them taste, their environment. And so they are incredible fish that are able to navigate these huge rivers with, amazing accuracy and getting to where they need to go.
Are they both threatened or are they endangered? I can't remember.
Good. Yeah, I'm sorry. I probably glossed over that. So pallid sturgeon are endangered.
Okay.
Shovelnose sturgeon are not necessarily listed. They are included under what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service calls a similarity of appearances clause. And that is, they look so much alike that in order to protect pallid sturgeon, they really want to protect both species.
Oh, interesting. And if they were to disappear from the environment, then how would that affect the river and the other things around it?
Yeah, so that's oftentimes a question that we'll get. And with pallid sturgeon, I don't often use the term keystone species, in that things might not necessarily fall to pieces without them. But that is a huge cog, in this working Missouri River Basin environment. And without them, you will really see changes in what that fish assemblage looks like, because these are a super long-lived fish species. And I'll get into kind of, what their lifespan looks like in a minute, but a very long-lived fish. They are the top predator in the river. And once those little baby sturgeon reach, a foot or so, there's not a whole lot that can eat them. And so they are, pretty tough. They're going to be around for a long, long time, and they will have certainly an impact on shaping what, an aquatic assemblage looks like for, the Missouri River, the Yellowstone River. And yeah, they're incredibly important.
Wow. Are the males and females different in appearance?
Not necessarily. We spend a lot of time, working with these fish and boating them. And, there are times where we could tell a male from a female, but typically outside of kind of reproductive periods, they don't have any characteristics that, show some sexual dimorphism. So there's really no difference in them per se. But when a mature female is close to spawning, there's a notable difference in kind of the shape of that body, that, some of these really old, mature females can carry, 100,000, 170,000, plus eggs, and can, put on a kilo or two just in, that sort of egg biomass. So they certainly have a big plump belly. Usually those males will be a little bit slimmer, but yeah, as far as kind of morphological features or characteristics, there's not a whole lot of difference between male or female.
Okay. And could you say something about their lifespan?
Yeah, and I think, the eye-catching part of their lifespan is that these are super old fish. We maybe don't understand just how old they can be. We do know that we have fish that are, 80, 90, maybe 100 years old. We have some really old fish in Montana. In fact, Montana, and
Wow.
into, western North Dakota, we have the oldest pallid sturgeon in the world. And these are fish that live a long time. And have a kind of patience that, many could probably admire, in that they don't have to reproduce successfully every year. They've got time. But for some of these wild fish, that time is all but run out. And we are desperate to find ways to, get some of the genetics captured for pallid sturgeon, knowing that we have a much smaller subset of individuals to, retain that genetic information in the population. And we know that, some of those wild adults might behave differently than some of our sort of hatchery-reared individuals that we've been really successful in propagating in the hatcheries and introducing into the river as, that kind of next generation after these wild fish, inevitably senesce. So the lifespan is really cool. But one thing I did want to, and I don't know if we kind of talked about, maybe covered it, but really is their life history. And so they live a really long time. But the interesting aspect about pallid sturgeon is just how migratory they are. And that's really, one of the unique aspects of them, but also, maybe one of the life history components that leaves them to be, in a bad spot, and ultimately, in an endangered status for the Fish and Wildlife Service. So these fish require really long stretches of river, upwards of, 200, 300 kilometers in length. And that is for adults to migrate upstream, to successfully reproduce and spawn, and for their larvae to drift downstream and develop. And that's where kind of one of the key components is missing for a lot of pallid sturgeon populations, that they don't have enough drift distance for those larvae to completely develop and ultimately sort of settle out of the drift of the river. Once
Okay.
they're settled out and once they grow, then they're pretty resilient. Once they reach kind of that, maybe foot long length, they are pretty tough little critters and will be around for a long time.
When the young hatch out, do they just look like minnows, or do they look different from most minnows that I'm familiar with?
So Roxanne, you said something that means something to me. So minnows, I'm going to dispel sort of a misnomer, if you will.
Oh, thank
Minnows
you.
are a family of fish,
Oh.
and they are in the family Leuciscidae. There are lots of fish that obviously start small and grow big, and people have always, since I was a kid, referred to essentially all small fish as minnows. But minnows are actually a specific group of fishes that we've got, a number of species in Montana. Sturgeon chub, sicklefin chub, those two I mentioned earlier, those are two species of minnow that are found in the Missouri and Yellowstone rivers. But so back to your point though, when pallid sturgeon hatch out of their eggs, and I don't know if you've ever had caviar, but those are sturgeon eggs. So little tiny black eggs. Once that egg is fertilized and that larvae starts to develop, it'll look a little more salt and pepper. There'll be some gray and white to the black. They will hatch out and just look like a tiny little globule with a tail. And then as they, work their way through that yolk sac and develop, they'll start looking like a tiny little sturgeon, a week into development. And then, from there, each day they start to look more and more like a sturgeon, and then after about, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, they are, a tiny version of their adult self. But
Wow.
when they're little, they are neutrally buoyant, maybe, slightly negatively buoyant. And they are just at the whim of the river. And so they are drifting downstream, and where that current goes is where they're going to go. As they, kind of develop little tails, they'll start to, show some more volition and kind of where they want to go. But for the most part, they're just drifting. And then when they finally kind of develop into a little sturgeon, that's when they will be, a little bit more benthically oriented. They'll be on the bottom and they'll be doing things that sturgeon do.
That makes me think of one other question. What kind of conditions do they need to spawn successfully?
Yeah, great. Really, we've done a lot of work over the years, decades, in order to kind of answer that question. And a lot of it has to do with the timing and the magnitude of flows. So with that, you've got, fish species that, maybe can reproduce in a lot of different habitats, might be cued by a lot of different environmental factors. But with sturgeon, it's pretty specific. So, those adults are looking to the environment and the flows to get that cue to move upstream. And what is really important is that, long stretch of connected river. And so with those flows, they will be attracted upstream, and they will kind of wait for other adults to show up. There'll be kind of a period of time where they're, really waiting for those eggs to fully mature. They're waiting for, males to show up and to look for, bits of habitat that have kind of a soft, sandy bottom, that are kind of found in certain bends of the river. And once they've kind of found each other and figure out where they're going to spawn, that reproduction, that successful reproduction, starts the clock on kind of that drift and development of eggs. So it takes a few days for those eggs to kind of, be fertilized, sit and hatch out. And then once those larvae are hatched out, they're off to the races and drifting downstream.
Neat. And historically, do we know where these species lived, and has that changed over time?
Yeah, so historically, pallid sturgeon were likely found all the way up to the Great Falls, and that Fort Benton down from Fort Benton up to where the Great Falls are, all the way down, to the Gulf of Mexico, essentially. They were probably far more abundant in the Missouri River proper, but we certainly do know that those fish were found, in the Mississippi River, and on down to the Gulf. However, it's been noted that they really did prefer the Missouri River, and there was something about the Missouri River that was attractive to pallid sturgeon. They've never been, a super abundant fish, certainly not as abundant as shovelnose sturgeon, but yeah, because of that, ability to migrate and move upstream and live a long time, they've been able to spread out, all the way from the Gulf up to, the Great Falls.
Do you know, like, when they were first counted or kept track of in Montana?
Yeah, so I believe so. The first sort of documented occurrence of pallid sturgeon in Montana was 1876, and but that was a giant head of a pallid sturgeon that was found
Oh,
there
my.
at Fort Benton, and I think at the time they thought that was a large shovelnose sturgeon. It really wasn't until a paper came out describing pallid sturgeon as a distinct species from shovelnose sturgeon in 1905. And that was based on an individual that was captured just up from the Missouri River. You have the Mississippi, the Illinois, and then the Missouri River kind of coming together, and just kind of outside of St. Louis. And that was where the individual that was used to describe pallid sturgeon came from. So not quite as long as other species, but that kind of owes to its nature of being, fairly reclusive. The Missouri River is not an easy place to necessarily, see fish or catch fish.
Thanks to Ken Lane and Red Blue Black Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks all the volunteers and supporters of KGVM. Thank you for those who marched in the parade Saturday. Thank you Zach Shattuck, Joe Hindi, and CNET.com, songsofinsects.com, and to Steve Grant and Kathy Katz for our nature readings from their books. and thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, watch the skies, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. See you next week.